Welcome to another episode of I Pledge Allegiance. This week, we're thrilled to bring on Ido and Roz, the founders of Blockade, who are building some incredible tools to improve the state of security in crypto. This week's episode will be hosted by Larry and Carl. They've spent a lot of time with the Blockade team and have put together a really exciting episode for you all.
Really excited to have you guys on this episode. I mean, we've known each other for a while now and have spoken a lot together about Blockade and you guys. But I don't know if most people know the Blockade story. I mean, you guys recently announced the fundraise, and I think for a lot of people, that's the first time they're hearing about Blockade. But maybe we can start at the start. How did you guys meet in the first place? How did you get to know each other as founders?
Yeah. First of all, Larry, thank you so much for having us. We have known each other for a while, and we're really, really happy to be here. So we'll start with how Roz and I met. We can maybe each share a little bit more about our backgrounds before that. So I guess it all started kind of on our very first day of our military service. So both Roz and I served in these kind of Israeli cyber intelligence units. I don't know if everyone here is kind of familiar with some of these, but some of the best cybersecurity researchers and developers in the world really come from some of these units. So we met there our very first day. We both had these independent dreams of starting startups. And over the course of 6 years or so, working together on various complex cybersecurity and cyber intelligence problems, solving and finding vulnerabilities in modern operating systems, browsers, cryptographic implementations, things like that, those separate dreams really became one shared one. And it was just a matter of time until we really kind of started Blockade after kind of our service there together.
Was it the sort of thing where you guys, after spending a few years in service, you knew that you are friends and you're like, okay, we know we want to start a company together. We're just not sure which company yet. Or was it, hey, we know exactly for you, Roz, you had the idea and then you recruited the other person to actually start Blockade. Tell us the genesis of how the idea formed and how you came together.
Yeah, so this is a great question. In Israel, so like as Ido said, from the places we come from, very technological places, like it's pretty common to start companies, whether it is right after the army or a couple years later. And Ido and I always had a joke of like, you have these alumni mailing lists that are saying like, hey, we started a new cybersecurity company, yet another cybersecurity company, but please join us because we have some crazy VCs on the cap table and crazy engineers and blah, blah, blah. And like we said, we want to do something different on the one hand. On the other hand, we want to do something that can bring our expertise and the team and the people that will come after us. And then we started to dive into blockchains in the crypto world. We knew it for a while, but we never had a chance to actually do a deep dive into it. The first thing that hits you in the face, at least hit us in the face, was security. So we started to explore these areas. We're both pretty technical, so like built out of POCs. And yeah, this is how everything started.
It's a really interesting story. And I think for a lot of founders and people who live in the United States or Europe, like they see all these amazing Israeli crypto and cybersecurity companies get formed. And I think they don't really fully understand like what about that military service teaches you guys and what is the experience you get to develop there that really sets you up for success in forming a crypto, either a security company or crypto company in general. What sort of stuff did you guys tangibly learn there that really helped you out?
Yeah. So I think one thing that's interesting about looking at these units as someone who hasn't grown up in these kind of environments is one way that we like to describe them is almost kind of like Hogwarts for nerds or for computer programmers. You take some of the top talent in the country, arguably the world, and you put them together to solve these kind of complex problems. And so there you get to kind of experience one, kind of facing off against challenges that no one else has solved before, and two, doing it in a timely manner and kind of productizing it in a way that brings operational value. And doing that over and over and over again really hones these skills that are super, super prevalent for great founders across the board in various different ecosystems. And then I think there's this great overlap between specifically cybersecurity and the crypto world, regardless of security in crypto, which is kind of our main focus in Blockade. But I think everything that happens in crypto revolves around security and requires these kinds of expertise and knowledge. So that's one of the reasons why I think there's so many great companies coming out of the space, specifically in crypto as well, but broadly across the board out of Israel.
I don't want to put you on the spot here, but we come across a few different founders from different units. As you've mentioned, there's Unit 8200. I believe that's the one that you guys served in. There's Unit 81, and then there's a few others. What would you say is the best unit?
Yeah, I think this is a great question. oftentimes I would split it up into a different kind of question. Initially, before joining kind of a specific unit, you go and do these cyber courses, right? And then during those courses, if we kind of take the Hogwarts analogy, it's almost like a sorting hat, right? You go and do these courses, and then from there, you kind of go and split up into these different units sometimes and things like that. And within those units, there's different teams and different projects and different kind of things there. And so I wouldn't necessarily say there's one unit that's better or worse than others. Obviously, different ones have kind of different teams and different goals and things like that. So my answer is a non-answer. They're all great. It's a matter of kind of where you're based, what teams, what you actually did there. Some kind of founders are kind of more so around development of kind of different user interfaces and things like that. And some others kind of work on kind of finding vulnerabilities. And those kind of roles exist across the various different units that you mentioned.
All right. Dodge the spicy take. That's good. Good neutral answer. I like it.
One of my observations with founders, and would love to get your reaction, guys, but with founders coming from Israeli military service, particularly the cybersecurity units, and to contrast that with typical Western founder coming in from academia, is when you guys build the companies, you take a much more commercial and applied research perspective and mental model to it, where the goal is not to focus on deep research. It's how to apply research or technology that's already kind of well understood and make a business out of it or make a product out of it, right? That fits customer workflows, has demand, or you expect to have demand over the next 12 to 18 months. Whereas it's just a lot less academic than maybe some of the approaches you see in the West or maybe even Europe. Would love to get your reaction to that.
Yeah. So I think it makes sense that like Israeli founders specifically from these tech units are like very practical. And I guess for us on the first months of Blockade, we were very focused on like, okay, so let's assume there is a pain on security in the application level in Web3 and in our ecosystem. So who will be the people that are like willing to pay for it? Who will be the people that feel this problem the most? Is it people that are building infrastructures? Are these traders? Are these application builders? And I think when you're taking this approach of looking on it very similar to research, right? Like asking the same set of questions for different people and understand exactly how the problem looks for each of them, it just makes you build for them and not building something that is non-relevant and is very theoretical and academical.
Maybe just adding on to Raz's point here, I think, again, tying into kind of the experience and kind of these cyber intelligence units, you bring in some of the best minds in the country, but you pit them against real world problems and actually needing to solve operational problems that are time sensitive and kind of, I would say in quotes, business critical, as opposed to students sometimes that get these kind of very much theoretical assignments and problems that are disconnected from any kind of, again, in quotes, business use case here. And so both Raz and I, during our service, we were awarded what is called the Israeli Defense Prize. For those unfamiliar, this is the most well-known kind of award that's given out to one team a year for a specific kind of operational success that also has unique technological achievements, but you need both. So these are kind of other well-known projects that have received this kind of same prize, as like the Iron Dome, other kind of things like that. And so you need one kind of great technological achievement, but also a practical and operational use case. And so I think that really is what leads us, right, across everything we do, is where does product meet customer? Because one doesn't exist without the other.
Yeah, I really like how you answered it. It makes a lot of sense. That kind of more business-focused and commercial mindset, it certainly gives you guys a huge advantage. We've spoken a little about your background, where you come from, that sort of environment, which allowed you guys to, you know, build Blockade. But maybe we can get to the idea, right? The actual startup of Blockade. Can you walk us through, and just for the listeners, like, what was the iteration for that idea? Or did you just automatically know exactly what you're going to build and raise money for it and built it? Or was there more a gradual idea maze process that you had to walk through to get to where you are today?
Product is a continuously evolving thing. And we're modest enough to say that it's continuously evolving and we're continuously developing and adding new features and listening to the market and to customers. But we will say, like Raz mentioned, right, we took a really kind of practical approach, essentially talked to everyone we possibly could about their various problems and where they see security and where it kind of approaches them. And across the board, really, everyone we talked to said, it's really, really scary to sign transactions. And it's really, really scary to operate in the space. And so taking those kind of comments, looking at the different profiles of people we talk to and kind of honing that in onto how an initial product would look like, working with early customers like the ones we announced in our funding announcement, like OpenSea, like MetaMask, like Rainbow and Zerion, to kind of develop that product and all the data that's required to actually build that product and make it work at scale. And we can dive into that and how that works, led to the initial iteration that various other customers across the ecosystem use today.
One question founders ask us a lot is, particularly founders who are first-time founders, is how do I actually get close to the customer? Like, how do I understand the customer problem And how do I do that without coming off as really annoying and pestering them and asking, hey, what sucks in your organization today? What do you need help with? And being perceived as really, really annoying. What was your process for actually getting to understand intuitively the customer problem and then working towards building for it? And I think a lot of founders who are listening, they'll really appreciate your advice here.
Ido and myself are builders. We really like to build stuff. So when we have a conversation with someone, for us, it's very easy to come a couple of days later with something that somehow works. So I guess for us, after we had this first conversation with someone, if we came back a couple of days later, a week later, with something that works, it might be very impressive for them and show them that you are actually serious. And I guess I see this as something that really opened doors for us.
That makes a lot of sense. And maybe this is a good jumping off point to actually talk about what is Blockade? What is the product, how it works, and all that stuff. So maybe to start us off, what is Blockade?
Yeah. So Blockade helps builders in the ecosystem secure their users from hacks, phishing, scams. Basically, we like to say that our core tech is the ability of giving a transaction and the point of view, determine whether this transaction will be harmful or malicious given this point of view. So I guess this is, in a nutshell, what we're doing.
And I've seen different investors, different customers even, refer to this product category, because there are companies in this category that it's not just Blockade. I've seen them refer to it as firewall service, transaction monitoring. When you guys try to get to the nutshell of it, do you have a sense of how you frame this product category?
So I think for us, as Ido mentioned, and we talked a lot about it, we come from a regular, more traditional security background. We're seeing transacting very much similar to executing code on your PC or mobile. And you know, no modern machine will ever execute code without, first of all, inspecting it. So we're seeing it very similar to modern antivirus. And I guess this analogy is like also something that we take really seriously when we're thinking about the product. So we often like to say that the best antivirus that ever built is the product that saw most of the data, right? Because like a regular antivirus cycle, see as much data as you can, and then like iterate. There are new technologies that you might flag as malicious. So you need to understand very quickly, why are you doing this? Or like new attack vectors that you're not able to detect. So you need to really quickly like understand, what are these attack vectors? And I guess what we do is very similar. So we're able to see a lot of data and to respond quick to it. So yeah, we're seeing it very much similar to an antivirus product.
There's quite a few layers to initiating, signing, broadcasting a transaction, right? The user starts up their wallet, they connect to Adapt, they interact with Adapt, which typically initiates the transaction that takes them back to their wallet. Then they complete it, sign it, it gets broadcasted using the contract that's on chain, and then that contract will kind of emit the functions or call the different kind of functions or events or whatever it might be, right? Where does Blockade sit exactly, and why did you choose to sit at that layer of this transaction lifecycle?
Yeah, Carl, you phrased it well. And I think we often use the terminology kind of transaction lifecycle as well. And I think Blockade sits across the entire transaction lifecycle. And it's important to do exactly that. It's important to sit at every single one of the points that you mentioned, because in every single one of those, you have different attack vectors, you have different risks involved. And every single one of those allows you to kind of provide another layer of security to make sure that you have this kind of defense in depth approach and kind of protecting users from anything that could be out there to harm them.
Yeah, that's super cool. And so from a business perspective, does that also broaden your customer base such that you can sell this preventative mechanism / protection to different layers of the application as well? So wallets, dApps, protocols, etc.
Going off of Roz's previous point here and answering kind of how do we classify the area of the market that we look at? So definitely, I think the way we look at it is kind of application security for Web3. And applications can be protocols, they can be dApps, they can be wallets. They all live on top of this like ecosystem that is kind of the blockchain, and kind of building a product that allows us to live across the entire transaction lifecycle and analyze everything across this various landscape allows us to solve broadly the problem of application security.
As you guys had the idea for the product, you started building the product. What are some of the challenges that only people who are building in this product category and this transaction lifecycle know about? Like, what makes the business of building Blockade so difficult? And what's some of the magic sauce you guys have to have some of the best product out there in the market?
Yeah. So I think Roz touched on this as well. And I think the secret sauce is the data and the partners that we work with. You mentioned this maybe before, Larry, but there have been other players in the space before us. There will probably be some after us. It's really easy to build an MVP here and say, hey, this transaction is malicious. And you may be right 1 out of 10 times, but it'll be increasingly difficult to be right 100% of the time, and increasingly difficult to make sure that you're also right and also allowing users to have pleasant user experience that doesn't have a ton of noise and a ton of false positives. And so the real problem is kind of building this thing at scale and doing it in a way where, one, you're actually protecting users and continuing to kind of circumvent various kind of mechanisms that attackers try to deploy in order to bypass Blockade and bypass some of the things that we're building. And also do that in a way that allows users to transact in the space without hearing a bunch of noise and having that kind of alert fatigue that is so common inside of some of the other competitors that we see.
That's actually been one of my observations too, where once I saw the product for the first time live, and I think it was MetaMask or OpenSea, I forget exactly where, intuitively to me, this was, okay, wow, this is probably the best form of the product that can be offered in the market. And you guys, I think, were some of the first to productize that in a way that was intuitive to customers, intuitive to your partners as well, not only just retail customers, and that kind of user experience of the antivirus. Because typically when people think antivirus, they don't think good user experience, right? They think bad, ugly, annoying user experience, but you guys got it just right. And would you say, once you released the product into the wild, did you see a lot of competition basically copy that sort of user experience? Or are people trying different approaches to this day?
This is a good question. We're really focused on our customers. We're really focused on what's next. We less so focus on what sometimes the competition does. I'm sure there have been some people that saw our kind of initial early success and said, this is a good place to start from. I think it's also very difficult to copy, right? The user experience relies on kind of the core engine and decision-making of, hey, this is malicious, or hey, this is benign. And kind of to create a really great user experience that doesn't say, hey, this random dApp that you're interacting with is malicious just because I haven't seen it before, is very difficult to replicate. And so even if they see what we're able to do without access to all the data that we have, it's very, very difficult for them to actually replicate it.
Yeah. And I think just to add a bit to it. So we were fortunate to work with these ecosystem giants that they just like dragged us, but like we had to do what we do very good, because when you see this scale of like these amounts of transactions, you can't let yourself like having false positives. You can't flag applications as malicious just because like you have a very low signal for it. So we were actually forced to build a good product here because of the scale of data that we saw.
It's actually a question I had as I was preparing for this recording, is what is, if you guys are able to share, what is the process for indexing new dApps, for example, to make sure that you don't accidentally protect the user from a dApp that is good, but you flag it as high risk potentially? What is the intuition around it and potentially the business logic you guys use to build that product?
Yeah. So when we're evaluating a transaction, everything starts with a simulation. We can talk a lot about simulation, but I guess an explanation of it would be basical. So just making sure the user understands the technical implications of what is going to happen here. But just doing simulation is not enough. And I think the easiest example would be an approval. So for example, let's assume you're using your wallet, you got an approval request, and then you're seeing a simulation output that lets you understand, okay, you're about to approve this token, this amount to this spender. But then there's a question of who is this spender, right? So this spender can be a Uniswap V2 router, but it can also be a bytecode that has a very obvious backdoor functionality in it, or that has a pattern of historical transactions that shows like a suspicious pattern, or this address was involved with other addresses that have been seen on other dApps that are malicious. So I hope it gives you some intuition around the process.
It does. It does. And I guess my natural next question is, how much customization do you guys need to do to support different chains? Like, if I remember correctly, you guys launched with Ethereum. I'm not exactly sure if you've expanded to other chains since then, but what's the process of doing this same sort of process for another chain like?
Yeah, so we're supporting various chains. We're looking on it as like a two-step process. The first would be building a very good simulation engine that just like is able of executing the opcodes of the VM. But then there's the process of collecting data, training the model, and being able to understand the different threats on this chain. These are the two steps of like onboarding a new chain.
One of the things I think you guys did differently than probably some of your other competitors in this category and just companies in general is you operated in stealth for far longer than what is the typical time to operate in stealth. Can you walk us through the intuition as to why you guys decided to do stealth for such a long time? I forget exactly how long it was. I want to say 8 or 12 months even. Why'd you do that in the first place?
This is a great question and one we kind of debated internally for a long time. I think the honest answer is really simply, we strive and continue to strive to build the best product we possibly can. And we alluded to kind of the data and working with the different customers and kind of the iterations that are required in order to build a really great product that is battle tested, has great accuracy, has great precision, doesn't have false positives. And in order to do that, you have to work with some of these really, really big customers like we do for a little bit of time in order to really kind of hone that product. And so the main kind of reasoning around this is we didn't want to just come out with a landing page and a product that doesn't work. We wanted to come out with something that's real, that's actionable, that has great stats, that has a great track record across various different customers across the ecosystem. And so one, it takes time to build that. Two, it takes time to deploy with those customers and actually run in their environments and kind of see the amazing results that we've been able to see over that time period, as opposed to some of our competitors that may have spun up a landing page, said, hey, we can do this. And at the end of the day, unfortunately can't.
And I think another reason would be that as long as you're operating in stealth, you're not committed to anything rather than your customers or design partners. But I think it just gives you the freedom of keep exploring and improving your product and your offering. And then when you understand, okay, I have something that works here, there are customers that are happy with it, you can just like announcing it and start exploding.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And man, I remember 15 months ago now, like I think we were kind of going back and forth, or at least I was going back and forth. I was like, should you guys launch in stealth, or should you announce and then iterate on product after you're already known? Because there were, I think, other competitors, and I'm not going to name names, that did launch and they didn't have the product fully formed. And I was like, man, maybe this puts you guys at a disadvantage. I forget if I told you that, but I was definitely thinking that. And it turns out, I don't think it really did. You guys made the right decision, I think, by staying in stealth for that long and really building deep relationships with those early partners you guys had, but kind of curious to get your take after the fact now that some time has passed.
Yeah, I think we made the right decision too. We're happy with it. I think generally in startup land and in founder land, you don't want to second guess too many things. But I think in this case, we're really happy with how things turned out. And I think more than that is exactly kind of operating without this kind of digital noise, without any inbound, without any kind of defocus, really let us kind of work with the customers we wanted to work with, that we wanted to focus on, build the product that we believed the market needed. And we're really excited that now we can share that with the world. And we've just seen an amazing response following kind of that announcement and our kind of recent funding round.
Drilling down a little deeper here, at what point did you feel like, okay, now is the right time to exit stealth? You mentioned getting comfortable with the product, having happy customers, but was there really like a point at which you felt, all right, now is the right time, or was it some other factor?
I think it was just a matter of where the product is. Do we have the bandwidth to kind of answer the demand that we knew was coming? And those two things kind of culminated in more or less October. And that's exactly when we launched.
Shifting gears a little bit now, my one observation on security companies and cybersecurity companies in general in the traditional technological space is the nature of the product, it really has to adapt to applications, the infrastructure that it's built to support. And as we know in crypto, the crypto infrastructure, whether it's wallets, applications, and the whole crypto stack, it changes every 2 to 10 years, right? Or 2 to 5 years, something like that, which of course impacts the sort of product you guys have to build. How do you think about that? How do you monitor developments in the crypto space to make sure you're not building a product for the last generation of technology?
Yeah, I think this is increasingly important when we talk about bull and bear cycles. One thing that's relevant in one cycle may not be relevant in the next, and listening to noise in one may be irrelevant in kind of the other. I think the honest answer is that you have to keep listening to the market. And I think that's one of our superpowers, right? Is how we talk to customers, how we continue to maintain those relationships at scale and hear their problems and continue to adapt and add features as kind of needed and as required. And I think that's something that every great company does, is continue to listen to the market and continue to execute based on what they're hearing.
And I think practically, so it is true that, you know, like everything changes super quick in our ecosystem. But I guess like, let's take an example of like key management. So key management can change a lot, but it will still be needed no matter what will happen, right? Someone will have to manage the key. I think for the problem we're solving, Blockade, we're seeing this as like the layer above key management. So people are going to execute transactions, or machines are going to execute transactions, but transactions are going to be executed. And as long as they're going to be executed, it has to be a component that will be able to scan these transactions, to scan this code that is about to execute it. And I guess from here, it's just a matter of making sure you're doing it good. And we talked a lot about the data that we're seeing by working with these ecosystem giants. So as long as we're monitoring it and we have a good feedback loop on going over it, I think we're on a good spot.
You know, I totally agree that the best way to de-risk business is to be hyper laser focused on the customer and iterating the product based on customer demands. But one thing that, of course, happens is once the company gets larger, don't know exactly how large Blockade is at this moment, but once the company gets larger, the founders or the founder, they have less time to speak to customers on a day-to-day basis. They're now running a company and they have a reporting structure, so on and so forth. How do you guys make sure that you as founders are always have a pulse on what the customer wants and don't lose track of the end customer when you're managing the actual business?
Yeah, there's two things that are super important here. One is kind of team and the other is kind of culture and how you build a team around a culture that is super focused on delighting customers. And of course, having founders involved is super, super critical, but having an amazing team that continues to kind of be super, super focused on delighting customers everywhere they look is the way that we think about kind of growing this and scaling this. And so we've done this at every point in time, right? With our very, very first customers. And even today, as soon as we get on a call, we loop in engineers as fast as possible. We make them feel like, and we honestly do, you know, that we're catering to every single one of their demands and every single one of their needs as we integrate. And after that as well, having super, super tight loops of communication directly with engineers and our engineers and their engineers. And continuing to do that, make sure that we're very, very, very in the loop into every single kind of product decision that they're making and can really, really respond to how their products are evolving over time.
One thing that I think would be really interesting for some of the listeners to hear about is some of the trends, security trends that you guys are seeing. I mean, you're literally boots on the ground. You see stuff on the hacker side, the fraud side, the scam side before anyone else, but you also see where the good guys and where the security practices are heading towards. Can you walk us through that? Like, what is the stuff only security companies in crypto know about that you think would be interesting for people to learn about?
One thing that we're seeing off the bat and following our launch is how attackers are responding to some of these kind of solutions on the market, primarily us, right? So they're looking for bypasses. They're continuously evolving. They're continuously probing and prodding our system to make sure that they can continue to operate these businesses that they've operated in the past. And so that's kind of the main thing that we're seeing is that attackers are just continuing to become more and more advanced. And we continue to kind of be there and detect that and adapt to that. And that's what's kind of so important in our solution, our continued kind of focus on the data we're seeing and how that's evolving in the space. And we're also seeing that we're getting better for it in this kind of arms race that is attacker defender that we're seeing now.
It's something I've actually been really curious about. When we say attacker, it's super impersonal, but you guys probably know who the attackers are or what sort of organizations, individuals they are at times. Like, can you kind of walk us through who's like the Michael Jordan of attackers today? What organizations is it? What country they're in? And what makes them so good on the attacker side?
Yeah. So maybe before talking about like the Michael Jordan, let's talk about what is the NBA? Like, what is the league that they operate in? These attackers are one, financially motivated. And a lot of them come from these kind of rings of, in the past, ransomwares or kind of other forms of cyber theft. But crypto is so overwhelmingly adversarial, not because some would believe that it's bad or something like that, but because there's just instant time to value for attackers. When you find a vulnerability or kind of a scam or some sort of exploit in this kind of ecosystem, it's just super, super quick to create that value instantly for an attacker. And that's why we're seeing so many of these players come into this space. And a lot of them are making a lot of money, whether they're independent attackers that are doing this for themselves or whether those are broader nation state sponsored actors that are kind of doing this to increase their GDP or fund their illicit programs. I will say that we do have research across the various actors and these in the space, and these are things that we'll be bringing up and coming out with in the near term. And so I don't want to spoil any of that, but we're definitely following this really, really closely and looking at how attackers are operating in the space.
Yeah, and definitely don't want to spoil the research you guys are going to put out and really keen to get a look at it once it's out. But if you're able to share, what percentage of the hacks, exploits typically come from, in crypto anyway, from state actors versus, you know, just individuals and groups?
Yeah, so that's not something I'm sure we can comment on now. But I will say that even individual players in the space are super sophisticated. And when you have hundreds of millions of dollars on the line, that's enough money to incentivize really, really smart and sophisticated actors, both on the independent side, as well as the illicit kind of state-sponsored side.
Vitalik had a post recently, Techno-Optimism, where he describes his new vision for his version, at least, of his acceleration, which is DAC, defensive acceleration. Not sure if you guys had a chance to read it, but I'm sure you align very well with his vision for what we should accelerate in crypto. Do you get the sense that overall the space is moving towards promoting and engaging more towards a defensive stance towards protecting crypto in the way that you guys do? And how do you feel about that trend overall?
Yeah, so we're very close with many of the biggest players in the space and kind of listen to their problems, not only from a security perspective, but their broader business goals. And I think in previous cycles, we all talked about how we can get more adoption, how we can get more users in the space. If I can cite one kind of survey that kind of Consensus did, which we work very closely with through our relationship with MetaMask, is that they questioned several thousand users in the space, that people that don't touch crypto. And over 47% of them said they don't touch the space because they feel there's too many scams. And so when you talk to some of these really bigger players, their focus isn't on how do they win 1 or 2 or 3 or 10% more market share, but it's how do we increase the market more broadly? And the way to do that is to make users feel that it's much safer. And so the biggest players in the space are leading the charge across how do we make the space safer? How do we kind of bring in more users? And we see what it is we're solving for them as kind of a bottleneck to kind of really opening that up.
Yeah. And I think in addition, we talked about the idea and how we started. When comparing conversations we're having today with prospects to conversations we had a year ago, like the problem is much more clear at the moment. Like people understand it and we don't find ourselves very much need to explain it to anyone.
Shifting gears a little bit. I mean, we've spoken a little bit, you guys, a lot about the product, a lot about the space you're operating in, but maybe we can turn a little bit more inward to Blockade and the culture you guys are setting up for the company. You know, culture is this ineffable thing, right? But it's such an important part of what makes a company great. Can you kind of walk us through what is the culture you guys are trying to set up at Blockade?
Yeah. So I think we have, I would guess, a very unique culture given that we are a Web3 company. So as I said, like we're a Web3 company, but people are working 100% from the office. Everyone are really good friends of each other. We're doing a lot of things together. A majority of the people came from same units in the army. Of course, we have people that like did not serve in these units, but I guess our culture is something that is based on cultures that have developed in these units.
Yeah, maybe I can comment on this from my perspective. Like when I first met you guys, it was really clear that you guys are pretty intense guys, right? Not like in a, oh, hey, like you're staring at me sort of way, but you can tell that you guys really care. You really care about doing good work, being responsive, and building really great product. And to me, I mean, that's part of the reason why we got so excited about investing in you guys. But that's such an important part of culture, right? To have that intensity and turn it towards the customer. And that makes iterating cycles so much faster. It makes the customer really trust you more, right? And it's so important. I think from my perspective, that's really easy to see once anyone meets you guys and probably other folks on the Blockade team.
Yeah, well, that means a lot, Larry. Yeah, our kind of focus on doing great work, doing serious work. I think there's definitely kind of a focus to that on everything we do. And we look at engineering and product and building it out and continuing to improve with the scrutiny that you would assume kind of some of these drill sergeants have in some of the units that we were a part of.
I think we, at least I did, I got through some of the questions I really wanted to ask you guys. Maybe we can get to some random grab bag questions. We'll see if these go anywhere, but maybe just a random one. But if you can wave a magic wand and change anything about either Blockade or the industry or just cybersecurity in general, what would you change?
Interesting question. This is something that I wouldn't necessarily change, but it's an observation of cybersecurity more broadly. And maybe something that I think other teams maybe should know is that oftentimes cybersecurity comes to solve a problem that is kind of an afterthought of a product. You build something, it works, attackers come, they try to break it, and then you need security solutions to solve them. And so the way that we look to and talk through some of these teams is that I think the way that we look at the space and the way that we look at the broader ecosystem is that with success, attackers and security challenges and these kinds of things are kind of imminent. So thinking about solving these things before some of these problems arise is super, super critical. So my magic wand would be used to kind of shifting priorities and bringing kind of security partners sooner to the processes and sooner to the product development cycle and sooner in the process solves a lot of problems later. So that's, I guess, my one magic wand.
My one unfully formed thought is one of the probably differences of running a cybersecurity company, probably compared to other companies in other categories, is you are kind of playing this competitive cat and mouse game, attacking, defending. And one question I had for someone who's running a company like that is, does that also make it fun? Like, it's almost like you are basically playing a game. You guys are the defenders, there's the attackers, and you're constantly trying to one up each other. Is there some sort of thrill to that when you're running a company in this category?
Absolutely. Even for most of Blockade engineers. So a lot of their time is spent on actually tracking these attack groups, from technically understanding other different attacks to tracking them on different channels. So yeah, I think it makes our life very exciting. I guess even compare it to a regular security product. So security products for Fortune 500 companies are very important and are doing a great job. But I think for us, we're a lot more on the front line and experiencing these attackers every day, their new developments. We're seeing the users that are getting hit by them. So I guess, yeah, it's very much exciting.
Yeah, maybe just to kind of emphasize Raz's point here, I think we're really close with a bunch of other founders, especially in the security space, Web2 security and some of these other things. And their day-to-day is, how do we find some sort of misconfiguration in some sort of deployment in some sort of customer and solve that and hope that an attacker hasn't kind of gone through and done some of these things. And the way that we see our product and the way that we operate in the space, I think is unique to even security companies more generally, is that we're really kind of facing off against attackers on a day-to-day basis. And that causes this kind of exact game of competition to kind of force us to continue to iterate. And so much of the product work that we do isn't something that a user sees, but something that a user feels, because it's not necessarily just a new kind of addition or a new kind of fancy whistle or something to the product, but it's actually making it continue to be better and better and better based on how attackers are operating in the space. And so there's a lot of friction there. And to be honest, we feel that the attackers are our real competitors, as opposed to, you know, other companies trying to solve similar problems in the space.
Yeah, and I guess just adding on to that, is there a thing that happens where attackers sometimes become defenders and defenders become attackers and basically join the other team? Because I think a lot of people, they've never worked in cybersecurity. They've certainly never worked in this special unit you guys worked in, and they're curious about these things.
With the limited things we can say, we definitely were on the offensive side of things for a while. We were doing that for the good guys, and now I think we're on the defensive side, again, for the good guys. I can't speak to the broader ecosystem and how much attackers become defenders and these kinds of things, but from our ecosystem and from our friends who are kind of in some of these cyber intelligence units, oftentimes that expertise of being on the offensive is really kind of great when you need to kind of think about how an attacker thinks and build a product to defend against how an attacker would work to try to break your product or any kind of product.
We've spoken about attackers and some of the groups out there. Can you give us an example, an illustrative example of just one group that does something like this?
Yeah, so one of the major group that is called Inferno, this is like a huge group that develops wallet drainers. They stole more than $70 million worth of assets from crypto users by draining their users. So recently we've seen a lot of messages by the development group that are very much worried about Blockade being deployed to every MetaMask user. And then a couple of days later, we've seen they just like announced they're closing the business. They're not going to develop any more drainers. For us, it was a very happy message. We're seeing this as like a one step forward. So because of us, Blockade, this group is no longer in business and the ecosystem will be much safer. So I think this one example maybe resembles things we're seeing.
So you're saying you drove your competition out of business?
I think what Raz is saying here is maybe to emphasize is we made their lives so difficult. They play a game of cat and mouse too. Just they're the mouse. And so by continually trying to find holes in different systems in order to continue to make the profits that they were making was difficult for them to do. They tried to probe and prod and kind of circumvent many of these things that we've been deploying over the past couple of months. And when they saw the final announcement that it was rolling out to 100% of users, they basically decided to close up shop.
That's awesome. Nail in the coffin for those guys.
Yeah, I think maybe just to hit this point again is too, is that there's so many attackers, right? Inferno is just one of them, and that have been successful in stealing $70 million from users across the ecosystem in just several months. But like Inferno, there are so many others that are continuing to operate and continuing to kind of persist and even take market share from Inferno, right? Like Inferno's users are now using their wallet training infrastructure. And so that's why it's so important to continue to use Blockade. It's a continuous game of cat and mouse. This time we caught the mouse and we were able to kind of drive them away. But we know that there's so many others operating in the space, and it's so important to just continue to improve and to defend users from some of these things.
Okay, honest question. What's more fun, attacking or defending?
I think both are fun.
I think both are fun. The way that we think about these things is oftentimes we build something and then we try to break it and we kind of iterate on that. So when you're on the defensive, you're also on the offensive. And so at least my answer is like, it's more fun to build something than it is to break something. But sometimes to build it, you got to break it.
Are there a few companies that you guys look to for inspiration, whether it's security companies or any companies that you looked at and you're like, wow, we want to be a little bit like them?
There's a couple of amazing stories around different companies that have built different security solutions across various other ecosystems that we see ourselves doing in this ecosystem. Two that come to mind, or at least for me, maybe Roz can add some more, are CrowdStrike and Cloudflare. I think both have kind of built really great security solutions that are data-oriented, that kind of see tons of traffic and need to continually iterate across solving these kinds of solutions in their respective ecosystems. Both security solutions, both in different categories, but both require this immense amount of data and are able to kind of build really great product with the more data that they do see.
Yeah, we talk a lot about like both of these companies, and we're very much fascinated by the facts of being able to see the critical data in real time and respond to it very fast. And both of the companies that Ido mentioned are doing this.
In crypto, we've seen bug bounties among like the more popular options for protocols and applications to adopt some level of passive protection, in the sense that they say, okay, if you are able to find some sort of entry or vulnerability with our program, we will reward you for it if you don't attack us, basically. How do you guys feel about bounty programs and their effectiveness in the space?
This is actually a really interesting point. So when we started our journey and dove into security and how it is done in the ecosystem, one thing that comes to mind is that like bounties are very important. It also shows that like these companies and protocols are very much serious about being secured and incentivizing individual players to come and help them improving the security. But I think something we really like about what we're doing is being very proactive. When we started to talk about Blockade, we split pre-production and post-production. Every industry needs both. So you need bounties, you need audits, you need people to go over the code on the pre-production phase, but also on the post-production phase. And as Blockade, we're very focused on the latter part. But as I said, both are very much needed.
I think maybe one more comment on that is that in traditional security world, where vulnerabilities are very much illiquid, and what I mean by that is it's very hard to actually create value from a vulnerability. There's a lot of operation that needs to be done in order to do that, whether that's selling it on some sort of market or whether that's actually using it to extract value. Those things become very difficult. And so oftentimes bug bounties are actually a good way for people interested in cybersecurity or even attackers to make money off of their vulnerabilities. In Web3, vulnerabilities are very liquid. As soon as you find something, you can generally create revenue or create profit very, very quickly, whether that's some sort of scam or whether that's some sort of vulnerability or exploit. And that actually forces the prices for these bug bounties to be really high. In Web3, we've seen some of the biggest bug bounties across any ecosystem ever. And I think it also makes it a big dilemma for attackers, right? Because you have this vulnerability in your hand, you can use it to make substantially more money, and you have this legitimate way of kind of reporting it to a project and solving this kind of problem, but you're kind of forced to make this decision that for us and anyone that we think is operating wholeheartedly to kind of make the space better is a really easy one to make. But unfortunately, for some financially motivated attackers, I think it makes the space all that more adversarial.
Yeah, that's a really interesting point on the liquidity of attacks in crypto, definitely. And just one last one for me, going back to the attack defense and which one you might prefer, do you guys often run internal attack scenarios against your own defense mechanisms? Is that a strategy that you use in order to beef up and attempt to find vulnerabilities with your own systems?
Yeah, so you work all day to protect from these new attack vectors. And of course, we as Blockade, so we have a lot of new attack vectors we detected in general in the ecosystem. We've seen attackers using them independently. Some of these, luckily, still haven't been exploited in the wild. But yeah, it's something we constantly do. So like we're seeing data and we're able to analyze it and understand that this, you know, attack vector or like this example. So of course, what you're thinking about all day long is, are there any other ones or how will attackers behave 1 month from now, half a year from now? So you're always challenging yourself with the question of trying to be one step before the other side.
Yeah, makes sense. I'm picturing a, I don't know if you guys know Pink Panther, but Clouseau versus Kato, he hires the ninja to attack him at any moment in kind of a secret way to always keep him on edge. That's how I'm picturing you guys right now with Roz, you always attacking Ido on weekends or something like that when he's trying to take some time off.
Not far from reality.
I think Ido and Roz are too humble to say, so I can say this for the listeners. I mean, Blockade is kind of the lion of defenders in the room, and then there's all these little mice of attackers. So if you need some security and you want to be protected, definitely chat with Blockade.
Awesome. Thank you, Larry.